It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 410. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. Send me a Facebook friend request, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. And of course, you can go to the wiki, which is mtswiki.com, where you can find links to all of the archive shows. I have a jam-packed show. Not sure if I'm going to get a chance to get to some email tonight, but I have lots of great things to talk about, from solutions and issues that I've been dealing with the last few weeks while I've been consulting. So I thought I would share a lot of those solutions with you and some of that work because it's important. I might touch on a couple emails that ask specific questions that I want to answer that I think are important. So before we get started, go to meeting. With colleagues working from home or traveling for business, getting everyone together, it's so hard. And you want to be able to see everybody. And that's why GoToMeeting now has HD faces. To look someone in the eye and see their reaction when you're presenting and to make that personal contact, nothing can replace that. I use GoToMeeting all the time. And now that all you need is a video camera, literally any device, and you can connect right up in seconds, you now can make that personal connection and that contact with a meeting. Before, it used to be just visual, and you just see the presentation or what you're sharing or collaborating with. But now to be able to see everybody, it just makes a world of difference. And for all Mike Tech Show listeners out there, you can try it free for 30 days. But you got to go to gotomeeting.com, click on the try it free button, and then use the promo code podcast. So that's gotomeeting.com. Click on try it free and use the promo code podcast. The first item I want to talk about, have a client that I inherited how they remote in to their desktops. And the tech before me set up port forwarding for the remote desktop protocol so they could use the remote desktop connection to multiple computers. So what does that mean? Remote desktop by default uses port 3389. Now, if you want to just forward that to one system, great. But what if you want to forward that port to multiple systems? That means you have to change the individual desktop client listening port, the port that it's listening for RDP, which is 3389, you have to change it, like 3390, 3391. You got to change that port number. So I'm running into this because my client upgraded to Windows 7 and RDP no longer worked. Now I have all the forwards set up at the firewall for forwarding each of those ports. So now I have to change the local port that it's listening for on the machine in Windows 7. So I thought I would just review that. And I have a link that actually goes over this entire process. The first thing you got to do is go to RegEdit. Now, when you go to RegEdit, something that I like to do, after you start typing in Windows 7, R-E-G-E-D-I-T, and it appears, before you click on it, right-click and say Run as Administrator. Then you can go in and change the registry. So one of the things you want to do now is go to HKEY local machine, then system, then current control set, then control. Then, you know, you keep opening up and just drilling down. The next one is terminal server. Then find WIN stations. Then find RDP-TCP. Once you highlight that on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, there's a whole lot of options. Now you can go right to port number. You can double-click it. And then you can now edit the port number. Pick decimal so you can actually type rather than hex. So you can now put in, instead of 3389, let's say it's 3390. Here's the catch, though. In order for this to work in a perfect world, you got to do a lot of work. You got to make sure that you have static IP addresses at the workstations. Then you got to make sure that your router can perform the function of port forwarding. Now, this one, of course, already did. And I already inherited static IP addresses. So half the battle was done. Now, when I upgraded them to Windows 7, I made sure that they had the same IP address, the same static IP address information. And now I changed the port, so this way the port forward would work with Windows 7. But you also have to change the permissions. Make sure that you invoke and allow remote desktop connectivity. You have to go into System Advanced Properties. It's pretty easy. If you click Start, now me, when I click Control Panel, I always like the large icons. So if you have large icons in Windows 7, you can then click System, then go Advanced System Settings. And in the top, there's Remote. And you got two sections. You got Allow Connections from Computers Running Any Version of Remote Desktop, or you can check Allow Connections Only from Computers Running Remote Desktop with Network Level Authentication. It's more secure. Well, I changed the middle one. Then you can select users, and you got to make sure that your local user is a local admin, or you now got to add him and that account in this section for who's allowed to come in for remote. So I had to change the permissions. I had to change the port. The forwarding was already done. That allowed this to work. And so I figured I would review that with everybody. And I'm going to have a link for how to change the listening port for remote desktop. But a whole lot of things have to be able to happen there. Your router has to be able to support the port forwarding, and you got to roll out static IP addresses. I believe there's better ways for remote access. And we'll leave that for a future discussion, where there are products and services out there that you can deploy that will make it a lot easier so you don't have to have static IP addresses. While we're speaking of remote access, I have a client that is deploying for the first time in his small home office Active Directory, and I helped him get 2008 R2 server up. He has a virtual server that's running a Hyper-V Windows 2000 within this 2008 server. We had a heck of a problem. One of the things he could not do, we could not RDP in. I mean, we had LogMeIn set up on the servers, but we could not RDP locally into the system. We kept getting an error saying that we were not allowed, that the terminal service licensing wasn't set up. It was driving me crazy, and I figured it out just literally 2 nights ago, and I remoted in, and it was because I found an article that said the exact problem in the forum. There was someone saying that they installed the OS and terminal server components on the machines, and now they can't remote in. By default, on any server, you're allowed 2 connections via RDP. You don't have to have terminal server licenses and all the CALs, which are client access licenses, in order for that to work. But I made a mistake. I installed the terminal server services, which was the remote desktop services, because I thought just because I wanted RDP, I needed that service installed. And that's incorrect. If you don't want to deploy this as a true terminal server and you just want the admin capability of two connections, which you're allowed by default on a server, all I had to do was remove remote desktop services, or in earlier versions of Windows, it's called terminal services. Once I removed that and reboot it, that solved the problem when we were able to RDP in without any errors. The way to make it work with those services, you have to activate and buy licenses for how many devices or users, you get to pick which one, which mode. I don't want to go down the road of setting up a terminal server, but you have to pick how many different unique devices may be connecting or how many users. And you could buy a per user license and then go through the process, have a licensing server set up. And once you go through all the proper configurations for the amount of users you want to be able to remote in, you're not going to get those errors. Most people on a small network, they do not need that. And they just need the easy remote desktop connection for two. Unless you're really doing a deployment for terminal services, don't install that service because it's going to get in your way. And unless you go all the way and get it fixed and actually add those client access licenses, you're not going to be able to get in via the remote desktop connection. Wanted to share that. Here's an interesting one to just keep in mind. And I know it's obvious, hopefully, for everybody that's listening. I get a panic phone call from a client where they are missing their My Scans folder. They have important documents that they regularly scan back to their desktop. And this is, again, another home office. I set this all up. It scans perfectly. He just goes in, picks his computer. It scans right back into a directory right on his computer. I said, don't worry. Let me remote in. So I remote in, and I don't see in his My Documents the My Scans folder. So the first thing I do, I start looking in other folders for the My Scans folder, because unless he right-clicked and deleted it, there's no way it would be removed. And there's no way my client took the time to try to delete it. Given the circumstance, he dragged and dropped it to another folder. I just knew it. And keep this in mind. This would always happen, I know, on larger networks where maybe certain people who probably shouldn't have full access do. It's so hard sometimes when you're moving your mouse and you don't realize you're picking up a folder and possibly moving it to another folder, and now it becomes a subfolder. So I've run into this, and that's why you first look at the recycle bin and see if they deleted it. And if they didn't delete it, then you know they dragged it somewhere else. So I start looking at all the folders. About the fourth folder down, lo and behold, there was the My Scans folder. I dragged it back up into the proper area where it should be in his My Documents. And he's like, oh, it's there and all my files are there and life is good. And I just wanted to point that out before you start pulling out the backups, looking to do a restore. Take a look around and spend the time. Yeah, Uncle Al in the chat, you could search for it. Yes, absolutely. Know the name of the folder and just do a search and you will get it. And most likely it's in a subfolder somewheres buried where they accidentally dragged it. That just took a few minutes the other night to solve for a client, and they were very, very, very happy. I wanted to mention that. I get this a lot. When I give the solution to this problem, I really got to go through a little more training. You have an iPad and the user wants to transfer files from their network to the iPad. Now, you would think that that would be pretty easy. Well, it's not. And one of the things that you have to do is buy an app called GoodReader. And GoodReader does not specify everything perfectly. It's not obvious. And I learned that just a couple days ago when I was in my client's office, and the president said, I want to move files from the network. You recommended the GoodReader. I've tried everything and I still can't transfer. Here's what you have to do. And I wanted to review this process with anyone. Once you buy GoodReader, you must be on a wireless network that is on the same network that you have access to those files. So that's very critical. You got to be Wi-Fi connected with your iPad and on the same network that you have a desktop connected that you want to transfer your files. Now, that desktop can have drives mapped to network shares, but you got to be on a desktop on that network. Once you launch GoodReader, at the very bottom, there's a little Wi-Fi symbol that we're used to seeing that shows Wi-Fi. Just click on it. When you click on it, it turns on a web server built into your iPad, and it gives you the IP address. Now, right now, mine says 192.168.1.152, which is the IP address it got on my network, and then :8080 for the port. So all you have to do is, once you invoke that, it's very simple. You now, once you invoke that, you type that IP address and :8080 into a browser, and you will be directly connected to the file manager of GoodReader. You now have an easy browse option to upload any files you want. They can be PDFs, they can be Excel spreadsheets, it can be anything you want. So while your iPad is on your Wi-Fi and this service is running, you can't be doing anything else on your iPad, it acts as a web server for you to browse and transfer your files. It's a piece of cake. Once I showed her that, she's like, I can't believe that. She clicked on every single option except that little Wi-Fi icon, and it made me think of something. I have two other clients that I recommended GoodReader, and they're still not transferring files. So I'm literally writing up these instructions, and as I was doing that and emailing them to my clients on how to do this, I thought, let me share this with everybody that's listening to the Mike Tech Show, because you might be in that situation. It's a little obscure, but boy, it makes a big difference to be able to transfer files from your machine or network and get them onto your iPad so you can be more productive. Then when you're done and you're happy and you moved all your files, there's a big stop option where you just click stop. It turns off the web server function, and then you have My Documents on your left-hand side in GoodReader, and it's all of your documents, and you can easily open them up, read them. Now you can take them on the go. It is, to me, the best investment and way to transfer files from a desktop computer or a network to your iPad. So now I want to talk about the following. A consultant contacted me yesterday and asked the following. He's more of a desktop guy, and he's not quite the comfortable with doing the server work, but he has a client that has a server, and they need to change the partition size of the C drive. And we find this a lot as I inherit servers that in the past you could get away with small C partitions. In today's world, you can't. You have to have a larger C drive, and you have lots of programs that just suck up the space, especially server-based antivirus programs. I hate them. I hate them with a passion, but you have to have them. Programs like Trend Micro and Symantec Endpoint Protection Security, they just suck the life out of a server. It's performance, and they suck the space, and they you have to babysit it, and you must care and feed your server, and you must take and go in and find where it's eating this space. Use a program like TreeSize, which is free, and then you get right to the culprit of where those files are, and you got to get rid of them. It's like cleaning up log files on older servers. You have to do it. So he wants to change the partition. And he's going to use EASEUS, E-A-S-E-U-S, Partition Manager. But there's a version, because this is a RAID setup, it's a RAID 5, he has to use the EASEUS Partition Master 9.1.1 Server Edition. It's $159, and it will work with RAID 5, and it allows you to install it and run it, and it's a great product, I know. I don't believe in partition software. It's just one of my pet peeves. I believe in naturally changing the partition. So one of the things I said, if you're going to do that, just make sure you get a great backup, a verified backup, a backup that you know works. Go to Shadow Protect, bite the bullet, buy the server edition, back up the server. Back it up to a cheap external drive. Once you get that, you test mounting the backup. You mount the drives and you see that you can read files from that drive that you just mounted. So you mount the backup so it looks like a drive letter, and you go in and you test and you make sure that you absolutely have a backup. Then go play with EASEUS utility. Me, I would make sure I had the backup with Shadow Protect, but then I would blow away the RAID partition, recreate the partition in the sizes I want, and then just restore right from the Shadow Protect backup. But I'm confident enough, because I have the experience with Shadow Protect, I feel confident about restoring it, knowing that I've done it before, and I know that I got a reliable backup. So he might not take that step, but he's going to buy the partition software, but he's also going to make sure that he has a good, solid backup. Don't dare try to do this without backing up your system. That's just insane. That makes no sense. And I don't care if you've done it 100 times. And I don't care how great the software is and how many times it worked. There's always that issue. How about a power outage in the middle of you resizing the partition and you've just destroyed your RAID? There are so many unknown things that can go wrong. You gotta have a backup. Plain and simple. Keep that in mind. And with that, this is a great segue on backups. Tomorrow, I have a client that is adding a couple new workstations, and part of the process is they back up to encrypted external drives. So what I will do tomorrow, I had them buy a couple external drives, one for each system. You know, these 500 gig and terabyte Western Digital Passport drives, they're phenomenal. They're great. Yes, they're $100 or a little more. So what? The cost of having that. I will get into a debate with anyone. If you're doing a backup, you don't need to back up to a RAID device. You don't need a NAS protected RAID scenario to back up. No. Rotate multiple cheap disks. Yes. And they're not cheap, but an external drive, that's fine. And you rotate that. But you don't need to back up your files to a RAID drive set. That's a waste of money. I don't believe in that. Have multiple drives that you can swap out and spend the money there. Spend the money on great backup software. Got off my box on that. They have some external Western Digital drives waiting for me tomorrow. I will bring TrueCrypt from TrueCrypt.org. It's free. I'll bring that on my little USB stick. I will run that program and install it on their system, and I will do a whole disk encryption, which only takes seconds because there's no data on that drive, and I'll do that to the external drive. I will make sure it is completely encrypted with a strong password. So now when they plug that drive in, it's literally a drive letter that can't be read. Let's say it's the E drive. They have to open up TrueCrypt, select the device, which they'll see is that E drive partition, and say, now mount it, enter the encryption password, and then it'll mount as the, let's say, the F drive. Now they can write to it. So now I'll set up the backup software to back up to the F partition, not E. F is the encrypted partition. So once they unplug that drive, if you take it to any system in the world, no one will be able to read it unless they have two things. They need TrueCrypt and they need the password. And if you have a strong password, even a weak password, no one's getting into this. No one can defeat it. It is an awesome, awesome solution for having an external drive encrypted with a password that you don't care if someone steals it or you lose it. You won't have that data in the hands of someone that shouldn't have it. So what I'm going to do tomorrow, I'm going to set up TrueCrypt. We're going to pick a password for each of these two users to their external disks. This is an environment of individual workstations. There are no servers. So that's why each workstation has to be separately backed up to an encrypted drive. Got no problem with that. And we're now compliant with all the different compliance that we have to be, especially FINRA. I got to make sure that these things work and that their backups are secured and they're protected and they're safe, that if they lose the drive or if something happens or if someone comes in and they steal it, no one's going to be able to get to that data. So that's something I'm doing tomorrow. And it made me think of something that I was actually literally yesterday afternoon. I'm setting up a lot of backups when I get to do work on, let's say, cleaning a system. So I had a new client, someone contacted me, it was from a referral, and their system was infected. I cleaned it, but then asked, what are you doing for backup? And they said, nothing. I said, I want to come back and install a backup solution for you. Even a home system, if they have Windows 7, great. The backup software in Windows 7 is not bad. It is better than nothing, and it's easy to launch and run. In the show notes for tonight, there's a one-minute video on backing up your files that's from Microsoft using the Windows 7 backup software. It's so easy. And you can, in the search, just type backup, and then it will do a system image with the file image. So you pick to set up the backup, do the files, make sure you have the external drive connected. So for the price of an external drive, and even if it's a home system, and I said, hey, you know what? Just at least do it once a week. So I said, pick a time that we want to do this. So he said, okay, Friday nights at 1 a.m. So you pick Saturday morning there at 1 a.m. for weekly. It's so easy. Set it. And it starts not only doing the files that can be recovered, it also produces an image. Now, there's an extra step. You also want to produce, and even if they don't have it, as long as if they're your client, you need a Windows 7 recovery disk. And it's so easy to make. Just type recovery and you can make that disk. Make a 32-bit and a 64. They're both the same. So all you need is two that you should carry with you at all times. And now, if that client, or that person that you set that backup to, if they come back to you and their hard drive crashed or something happened, maybe you got to put a new hard drive in. Say, hey, you got your backup? No problem. You boot. You take a brand new hard drive and then you boot with that rescue disk. With the external drive plugged in, you can actually pick that system image and recover it. It is a piece of cake to do. And it's easy and it's built right into Windows 7. So all the people, machines, and everything that you're working with, it's set for Windows 7. And you have it built in. So you don't have to buy anything. Now, I know consultants, and I agree with this. If you sell as part of making money backup software, go right ahead. As long as it's easy to maintain and configure and get going, and you can make money with it, go right ahead. But with the lack of that, if you don't have software, you don't want to sell them additional software, It's built right in. And maybe you're listening to me right now and you're like, boy, I haven't done a backup and I didn't want to spend any money on software. Well, guess what? You have it and it's included with your system. Just buy an external drive. And while you're buying that drive, why not buy it using my link to Amazon? And that's amazon.mikenation.net or miketechshow.com/Amazon. And that will make a contribution to the Mike Tech Show. I get a commission from all the purchases. And let me tell you something. I want to thank you, everybody who's been using my link. Thank you. Thank you. Last month was the best month that I've ever had since I've been promoting my Amazon link. It literally was. And this month is just started taking off and it's been great. You've been using my link. Continue to use it. Continue to share it. That truly helps me and helps the show. And I thank you so much for all that great support. I have some independent music for tonight. And I am so glad to play Rob Coslow. And I picked a song. It's actually pretty long. It's over 6 minutes, but very soothing. And it's called Forbidden. Give a listen. It's very soothing. He's an incredible pianist. And it's his music that you hear in the intro and the outro of my show every week. It's from one of his other songs. I'll have a link so you can support Rob and purchase his CDs. And I'll have that in the show notes. Give a listen to this. That is Rob Coslow, the song Forbidden, CD title that this came from is called Reconstruction. So I will have a link to where you can purchase that beautiful music. I can listen to Rob Coslow just all day long. And if you need to be relaxed and soothing music, and sometimes you just need to unwind, that's some great music to listen to. Love Rob and all of his work. Just great pianist. I want to thank all of you for staying subscribed and listening to the show. Hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Visit MikeTechShow.com so you can get the links to the show notes that I'll put up there. Thank you so much for your support. I really appreciate it. And I will see you next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit TechPodcast.com.